Coming up, as the U.S. Supreme Court takes up same-sex marriage, Kim Lawton looks at how growing social acceptance of LGBT issues poses new challenges for evangelicals. Also, Americans in prison, especially African Americans. Tim O'Brien reports that the U.S. has more people behind bars than any other country in the world.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. There have been sharp new moral questions this week about America's use of weaponized drones in the war against terror. President Obama acknowledged that three Americans, one of them a hostage, were killed in U.S. drone strikes against Al-Qaeda. Two of the Americans were suspected of working with Al-Qaeda, although the president said they were not directly targeted. The third, Warren Weinstein, was a longtime aid worker who was abducted in 2011. Obama apologized for the killing of Weinstein and an Italian hostage. Some critics say the U.S. drone campaign violates international law. Global leaders sought new solutions after nearly 1,000 migrants drowned last week while trying to cross the Mediterranean and find refuge in Europe. So far this year, almost 21,000 migrants, most of them from the Middle East and Africa, have attempted to flee violence and poverty by boat. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the world has a moral imperative to address the crisis. Moon will meet with Pope Francis about it this coming week. This has been a key issue for the Pope. He urged compassion and assistance for people he said are leaving their homelands to find a better life. Italian prosecutors say they broke up a terrorist ring of Islamic extremists who were planning a bomb attack on Vatican City. Many suspects were arrested. Security has been heightened at the Vatican in the wake of this and other threats by ISIS. Pope Francis has said he realizes he may be a target, but he mostly fears for the safety of the pilgrims who come to see him. Concerns about rising religious persecution ratcheted up yet again after ISIS released a new video showing the executions of dozens of Ethiopian Christians in Libya. Religious groups, including several Muslim groups, condemned the killings, and the White House did as well. But several activists are pushing the Obama administration to do more. A coalition of Christian leaders urged the president to appoint a special envoy to help protect religious minorities around the world. The post has been vacant since it was created by Congress 8 months ago. The Vatican confirmed this week that Pope Francis will visit Cuba on his way to the U.S. in September. Many American officials credit Francis with helping to pave the way for new U.S. diplomatic relations with Cuba. Popes Benedict XVI and John Paul II also visited there. Francis has accepted the resignation of Bishop Robert Finn of Kansas City, Missouri. Finn was convicted in criminal court in 2012 for failing to report a priest who was suspected of child abuse. The Vatican said Finn's resignation was accepted under a provision of church law that lets bishops resign early if they're unable to fulfill their duties because of illness or another grave reason. Many Catholics have been calling for Finn's removal since before his conviction. Advocates for victims of child abuse praised the resignation, but renewed their calls for more accountability for church leaders who covered up abuse. Friday marked the 100th anniversary of the massacre of Armenians by Ottoman-era Turks, and debate has continued over whether the mass killing should be called genocide. Many countries, including the U.S., avoid using that word out of deference to Turkey. This week, several prominent U.S. Muslim groups said the events of 1915 should not be characterized as genocide without more investigation. They said acknowledgement of the suffering of Armenians should be balanced by recognition of Turkish and Muslim suffering during the same period. Other religious groups insisted the massacre of Armenians should be called genocide. Same-sex marriage is legal in 36 states and the District of Columbia. This coming Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a closely watched case that could legalize it in every state. Religious groups have filed legal briefs on both sides of the issue. Prior to the arguments, many faith leaders have been calling on their congregations to pray about the upcoming decision. Evangelicals are among the religious groups most opposed to gay marriage. Kim Lawton reports now on how growing social acceptance of LGBT issues is posing new challenges for the evangelical community.
This is Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Jennifer Knapp. She's leading a workshop on faith and sexuality at a conference co-sponsored by Vanderbilt Divinity School. It's a vastly different gig from the days when Knapp was considered one of the top artists in the very conservative contemporary Christian music scene. In 2010, after a long hiatus, Knapp publicly came out as a lesbian. She says reactions from some in her evangelical audience were deeply painful.
Burn in hell, you're going to hell, you know, there's something wrong with you and your faith. You're not a Christian, you've never been a real Christian. Anything that you've ever contributed to the faith community is a lie.
But she has received support from evangelicals as well. And as society increasingly accepts LGBT issues, Knapp says she sees more and more evangelicals re-examining their views.
I think it's an error to write off faith communities as incapable and as negative to the LGBT story. In fact, quite the opposite. I think there are people there that are ready to love and embrace and shift the balance of what we see as the LGBT acceptance in our community, and from a really beautiful level, from a level of faith and spirituality.
Evangelicals have been among the staunchest opponents of homosexuality. They cite the Bible.
The traditional understanding of how the Bible teaches sexuality is that sex is something between one man and one woman in a monogamous marriage, and that anything outside of that is considered to be sin against the laws of God.
J.D. Greer is pastor of the Summit Church, a megachurch in Raleigh-Durham. He doesn't believe large numbers of evangelicals are changing their minds, but he acknowledges homosexuality can be a tough issue.
It's difficult to talk about because people immediately make assumptions about you and how you feel. If you say, well, this is wrong, then there's assumptions as to, you know, oh, that's a spirit of hate. It's something I think is challenging for pastors to reckon with, wanting to be faithful to what the Bible teaches, what they believe the Bible teaches, and then also be loving toward people and embracing.
With the Supreme Court taking up a case that could recognize same-sex marriage across the country, conservative Christians are debating how best to respond.
It seems every single week there's another flashpoint somewhere around the country over this set of issues. Not to mention the personal questions of how families grapple with these sorts of questions and how churches articulate our beliefs on those things. I think it's one of the most pressing issues we face right now.
Russell Moore is president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission and currently one of the most prominent evangelical voices on gay issues.
Christianity has existed in cultures that were very hostile to the way that we see the world. And so American culture is changing. We simply have to hold on to the truths that we believe have been articulated to us. And we have to do it in a way that is balancing both truth and grace.
Numbers can vary depending on how evangelical is defined, but strong opposition to gay marriage persists. A 2014 poll by the Public Religion Research Institute found that almost 70% of white evangelicals opposed same-sex marriage, the highest of any religious group. However, the same poll found that 43% of millennial evangelicals, ages 18 to 33, would support it. At this year's annual conference of the Gospel Coalition, several sessions were devoted to discussing how best to confront the wider culture.
I think some younger evangelicals have grown up even not even knowing or not understanding that Christianity requires you to push back against the world.
Still, the coalition's Colin Hansen is among those arguing for a different tone in the debate.
What might look courageous to you might look bigoted to somebody else. So our challenge is in our courage to look like Jesus looked, which is also fully compassionate and loving toward those, even those he was confronting.
One of the things that we teach at our church is you have to love the person you're talking to even more than you love your position on this issue. It doesn't mean you compromise your position on this issue. It just means that your love for the person goes beyond that.
While some LGBT advocates welcome a new, kinder tone from evangelicals, many say without a change in message, it's not enough.
It's sort of like a trick, right? It feels like a trick. Someone will feel safe to come out or share their story, and, you know, they won't feel safe after they've come out, or they'll be, you know, told to not act on those desires, or that celibacy is the only option for them.
Brandy Daniels says after she came out in 2006, she was no longer welcome at her evangelical grad school. Now she studies queer theology at Vanderbilt. She says denying LGBT people the right to marriage is tantamount to withholding spiritual benefits from them.
By denying, you know, same-sex couples that opportunity, we're denying them an opportunity to experience and participate in God's love for us and for one another.
Some are urging conservative Christians to reconsider their interpretations of Scripture, particularly passages on sexuality by the Apostle Paul. Matthew Vines is author of God and the Gay Christian.
We don't see in any kind of consistent or widespread or prominent way in ancient literature long-term, faithful, monogamous same-sex relationships between equal status adult partners. And so what I'm saying is we just need to recognize that Paul is not speaking to the question of same-sex marriage, nor is he speaking to the question of gay Christians.
Vines grew up in the evangelical world. In 2012, he posted a YouTube video of a more than 1 hour long scholarly lecture where he argued that it is possible to affirm the full authority of the Bible while also affirming committed same-sex relationships.
What the New Testament teaches about marriage is that it is fundamentally about a covenantal commitment to one spouse. It's about self-sacrificial covenant love that reflects God's love for us in Christ. Same-sex couples are just as capable of living out that kind of a relationship as are opposite-sex couples.
Most evangelicals are not persuaded.
God created and designed marriage and sexuality, the one flesh union of a man and a woman, to picture the gospel of Jesus Christ. We didn't make these doctrines up. We received them from Jesus and the apostles, and we don't have any authority to change them.
Are a majority of evangelicals that ready to change their positions right now? No. But some of them are, and all you need is some people who are willing to do that and then to give them the biblical basis and argument to support that position. And if they can stay in their churches after changing their position, it starts to significantly shift the dynamic.
Also hoping to shift the dynamic, Jennifer Knapp has started a group called Inside Out Faith, which encourages gay people of faith to share their stories, just as she has.
I think the challenge is for us to be able to be compassionate to one another, to try and let our particular views and our experiences not be things that are mandates that other people have to accept.
Greer agrees about the need for more compassion in the debate, but says evangelicals must have the right to stay true to their convictions, no matter how unpopular in the wider culture.
We want to respect your right to say what it is you think, but it's not fair for you to turn to us and say you don't get to express your viewpoint, because immediately, even though you agree with 2,000 years of church history, how Christians have interpreted it, what you are saying is out of the bounds of civil society.
And that's a debate that will continue no matter what the Supreme Court ultimately does. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Now, an issue that many people think is a long overdue injustice demanding the country's attention. The enormous number of Americans who are in prison, especially the large number of African Americans. Tim O'Brien reports the U.S. has more people in prison than China or Russia or any other country in the world.
While the crime rate has steadily declined in the United States over the last two decades, the incarceration rate has all but exploded, from around 300,000 in 1972 to roughly 2.3 million today. The United States has only 5% of the world's population, but nearly 25% of the world's prisoners.
We cannot maintain our credibility, our legitimacy as a nation, when we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world.
Brian Stevenson runs the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, a public interest law firm devoted to representing youthful offenders and those who cannot afford a lawyer.
We've got 6 million people on probation and parole in this country, 68 million Americans with criminal arrests, which means that when they apply for a job, they're going to be compromised, they're going to be disadvantaged.
How did that happen? Why are so many Americans in prison? Stephen Raphael and Michael Stoll, both economics professors, have been studying the issue for more than a decade and have written a book asking that very question. And they've come up with two surprisingly simple explanations. Mandatory drug sentences, particularly at the federal level, and often for nonviolent offenses. And in the state system, longer prison terms for violent offenders. Whatever the reason, and there are others, the authors insist the trend toward mass incarceration has not been cost-effective.
We could, instead of spending so much money on incarcerating very old inmates, we could also use that money to hire more police. We can use that money to have anti-violence interventions for youth. And we can be more proactive about having a society that is less violent and generates more productive citizens.
The cost of keeping a single inmate in prison varies widely, from almost $15,000 a year in Kentucky to more than four times that, $60,000 a year in New York State. Overall, we now spend roughly $80 billion a year on jails and prisons, compared with only $6 billion in 1972, a 13-fold increase. Still, when someone commits a horrible crime, the victims, their loved ones, and many others want justice, that is, retribution. And to some, that means sending the offenders away for a long time, regardless of whether they might ever do it again.
You know, if somebody takes an eye, you can't just be like, oh, slap on the wrist. You can't.
Getting tough on crime has taken on a life of its own.
Once you enact tougher crime legislation, it's very hard to get soft on crime. People campaign on getting tough on crime. Opponents could match the intensity of that by saying they're just as tough as getting on crime. And virtually no one, at least up till now, gets elected by saying they're going to reduce sentencing and get soft on crime.
Just ask Michael Dukakis, whose support for a prison furlough program while governor of Massachusetts may have cost him the 1988 presidential election.
Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
The impetus for mandatory drug sentences and long prison terms may have been the soaring crime rates from 1960 to the late 1980s. There's a growing body of evidence, however, that those remedies in some respects were not only unfair, they were racially discriminatory. And there can be no question that the so-called war on drugs has had a disproportionate impact on people of color, Hispanics, African Americans. The National Institute of Justice reports that African Americans are incarcerated at nearly six times the rate of whites, and that if the trend continues, one in four black males alive today can expect to spend some time behind bars. It is true that those in the lower socioeconomic classes are more likely to commit certain crimes, but Raphael and Stoll insist that does not explain the gross disparity in sentencing, noting that the incarceration of young black men charged with drug offenses has been a key driver of prison growth.
Crack cocaine possession had a sentencing link that was 10 times as stiff as that for the possession of powder cocaine.
Or 100 times.
100 times, right. Yeah. Now it's been reduced down to 12, but it was 100 times greater than for possession of powder cocaine. Blacks traffic disproportionately in crack cocaine relative to powder cocaine.
However, there are also other issues, right? I mean, it's the case that African Americans, when they're charged, they're less likely to make bail. They're less likely to make financial bail. People who are held in detention pretrial are more likely to plead guilty and are more likely to be sent to prison. There are some who believe there's aspects of the criminal justice system that are unfair, that there might be discriminatory treatment by police, by prosecutors, and by judges, and so on and so forth.
We have a history of racial inequality and racial justice that has left us compromised, left us vulnerable to presuming guilt and dangerousness when minority people interact with the criminal justice system. I think too many black men and boys are presumed dangerous and guilty when they're walking the streets.
Brian Stevenson has earned a reputation as one of the leading civil rights advocates in the U.S. Supreme Court, having won landmark cases on the rights of juveniles. He says racial bias in our justice system may not always be obvious, may not even be intentional, but that does not mean it isn't there.
I'm a middle-aged lawyer. I've been practicing law for 30 years, and even I get presumed dangerous and guilty sometimes. I was in a courtroom in the Midwest, getting ready for a hearing one day, and I had my suit on and my shirt and my tie, I think it was maybe this suit, and sitting at counsel table, and the judge walked in, and he saw me sitting at defense counsel's table, and he looked up and he said, hey, you get out of here. I don't want any defendant sitting in my courtroom without their lawyers. You go back out there in the hallway and wait until your lawyer gets here. And I stood up and I said, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't introduce myself. My name is Brian Stevenson. I am the lawyer. And the judge started laughing and the prosecutor started laughing. I made myself laugh because I didn't want to disadvantage my client. And then the client came in, a young white kid who I was representing at this hearing. We did the hearings. But afterward, I was thinking to myself, what is it about that judge that he sees a middle-aged black man in a suit and a tie at defense counsel's table, and it doesn't occur to him that's the lawyer? Do I think that that judge is going to treat minority defendants differently? I do. Do I think that's going to manifest itself in sentencing disparities based on race? I do. And that's not somebody who's consciously bigoted. That's not somebody who is proudly racist. That's just somebody who has inherited this narrative of racial difference that compromises us in all kinds of ways. In the criminal justice system, you see evidence of that in ways that are very, very problematic.
If you ran the zoo, what would you do?
I would certainly do away with mandatory minimums. I would stop incarcerating people for drug possession, and I would declare an end to this misguided war on drugs. I would eliminate some of these extreme punishments. I would stop treating children as an adult. We've got now some 250,000 people in jails and prisons serving long prison sentences for crimes they were alleged to have committed when they were young children. And then I would actually engage in the kind of serious rehabilitative work that you see in many countries in Europe.
The mass incarceration phenomenon has not escaped the attention of the Obama administration, which has moved to reduce sentences for minor drug offenders and more aggressively pursue drug kingpins and violent offenders.
We put sensible limits on when it was appropriate to seek stiffer sentences based on a defendant's prior criminal record. And we took steps to improve reentry processes in order to reduce the chances that incarcerated individuals reoffend after they exit prison.
The vast majority of prison inmates are in state prisons, however, rather than federal prison, almost seven times as many. But some states are following the Justice Department lead, like Texas. According to a report by the Council of State Governments, a conscious effort by the state to send young offenders to counseling in community centers rather than to jail or prison has helped to cut crime.
And we found that the kid who stayed in the community was 20% less likely to reoffend than the youth released from the state correctional facility. Furthermore, we found that the kid who was released from a state correctional facility was three times as likely to be rearrested for a felony than the youth who was under community supervision. And here's the most interesting thing. We also save a whole lot of money keeping that kid closer to home.
A blip on the radar, or are we on the cusp of a new approach to crime and punishment? The old approach, mass incarceration with lengthy sentences, may have made some Americans feel better. It does not appear to have made anyone any safer. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington. Finally, a beloved but controversial relic has gone on rare public display. The Shroud of Turin is being exhibited through June 24th in Italy's Turin Cathedral. Many believe it could be the burial cloth of Jesus. The linen contains a mysterious photo-negative image of a bearded man with wounds similar to gospel descriptions of Jesus's when he was crucified. The shroud has generated much devotion, but also much debate. Some scholars consider it a medieval hoax. The Vatican takes no position on the shroud's authenticity, but calls it a reminder of Jesus' death and resurrection. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website, including longer interview excerpts from some of the people featured in this week's stories. You can also listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more of singer-songwriter Jennifer Knapp performing Mercy's Tree.
Left of me, you can bury what's left of me. Oh, you can bury what's left of me on the Mercy's Tree.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.